Ray versus Ready individually and another as one of them, though Allison R. W. Pep, Common Council, Aubrey A. Graham, the third act, how you sound?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Allison Heff, and I'm here for Ms. Ray. May I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal? Ms. Ray, through counsel, filed what was captioned as a complaint for claim determination and enforcement of elective share of augmented estate. She filed it in the Henrico County Circuit Court because by statute, section 64.2302B, that court has subject matter jurisdiction because Ms. Reedy had qualified as the administratrix in Henrico County Circuit Court. Ms. Reedy was served and answered as the personal representative of the estate. She raised no jurisdictional challenges in her answer, and she did not file a plea in bar. Through counsel, Ms. Reedy offered to amend to make clear that she was the proper party defendant. And before the hearing on the merits, and just days after the statute of limitations would otherwise have run, Ms. Reedy moved to dismiss the claim, or to dismiss the complaint, claiming that it was a nullity. Now, this wasn't a decree against the dead person, but nonetheless, Ms. Reedy argued that it could not be corrected.
May I interrupt you there? In our nullity cases, Swan, Payton, and the rest, correct me if I'm wrong, but we never said that because the pleading is a nullity, that therefore the lower court had no subject matter jurisdiction. Of course it had subject matter jurisdiction. We just said the pleading had no legal effect. Is that fair?
That's fair to say with regard to subject matter jurisdiction. This really is not a subject matter jurisdiction case. The issue that's raised by Ms. Reedy goes to the other instances of jurisdiction, which, of course, have to be raised either prior to the pleading or simultaneously with, or their ways.
Now, with the exception of the nullity concept, which, like subject matter jurisdiction objections, but not in fact subject matter jurisdiction objections, can be raised after the fact. And I guess that what I'm building to is, tell me if this is right or wrong, 8.01 to 6.3 was really a response to our nullity cases, wasn't it, 2010?
Yes and no. First, to respond to the nullity cases, you mentioned Swan. And that cites back to the Reynolds decision from 1927. Our position is that it sort of miscites what Reynolds was holding. In Reynolds, what the court ruled was that people who are dead, who are passed beyond the jurisdiction of the court, so suits and writs against the dead are a nullity. In that case, what was before the court was a writ of error, and the court sustained the motion to dismiss because there was no attempt even to join the personal representative. You couldn't proceed against a dead person. Now, that's in 1927. Swan was decided in 96, and then thereafter, Parker was decided, also citing Reynolds. But our position is that, you know, the real argument is that 801.6.3 is remedial in nature. Nothing in that abrogates the provisions of the other statutes, whether that's 801.5, 801.6, and it doesn't eviscerate the rules or change the longstanding precedent of this court that leave should be freely given, particularly where the discretion to be exercised is exercised in favor of a decision on the merits. Here we have a party before the court. When the party to be substituted is either already before the court or bears a close relationship to the named party, and when there's no change in the cause of action, there's a long line of precedent from this court that says leave to amend should be freely given.
Let me ask you a question, if I might.
Yes.
This case in the court below was styled as Patricia L. Ray versus Estate of Keith F. Reddy. This case has been filed here actual filing of it here. Patricia L. Ray versus Catherine Reddy, individually and as administrator of the estate of Keith F. Reddy et al. Given that the nomenclature and the actual naming of the party is the issue, by what authority do you have this, the ability to change the caption and the name of the case?
That's a good question, Your Honor. The issue here was that Ms. Reedy was the party who actually answered, and she entered an appearance in her capacity as the administratrix. So she was the party who presented these arguments in the court below, and she's the party against whom we took the appeal.
But the assumption behind that, which makes perfect common sense, don't misread me, but normally a general appearance presupposes that you've been sued. People that show up that are not sued, that have not been served, don't make general appearances. They just show up. We don't have a word for that other than they show up.
Well, it's sort of like the case in Gilpin, and that was a 1999 decision from Justice Koontz, where a party did voluntarily appear and later argued jurisdictional challenges, and the court found that where you voluntarily appeared, as Ms. Reedy did here...
Was that party sued in the case?
I'm sorry?
The party that voluntarily appeared, that were they served with process?
So in Gilpin, yes, they were served with... Or actually, no, they were not served with process. This was one where they... The issue before the court was kind of interesting because the party had tried to invoke the statute on how process was to be affected. And Justice Koontz said, you can't avail yourself of that particular statute because you weren't sued.
Right,
you weren't
sued. I apologize, but I think I misspoke. Was that party a party?
They were a named defendant.
Okay, well, isn't that a huge difference?
It is a difference, but I wouldn't characterize it as a huge difference because there, the defendant in the Gilpin case was served after the statutory period to effect service, and by voluntarily appearing, they waived their challenge that the service was somehow defective.
Okay.
I will concede that this is sort of a unique situation before the court.
So your best argument is that 6.3 in 2010 was not meant to cover the field, that there's discretion outside of that where you don't have the proper party before the court, and it relates back because obviously everything is turning on the statutory limitation period relation back concept.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's similar to the Siska opinion where Justice Lemons held that the necessary party doctrine doesn't implicate subject matter jurisdiction. And because this does get back to a jurisdictional issue, this is one of the other jurisdictional types of challenges that does have to be raised, and it has to be raised at the outset of a party's pleadings, if not before the filing of an answer. The reason that that's the requirement is you get to a situation like this. Had Ms. Reedy raised the jurisdictional issue from the outset, Ms. Ray could have non-sued it and refiled within the statutory period. Because Ms. Reedy entered her appearance, defended, asserted an affirmative defense, not on jurisdictional grounds, and sought affirmative relief in the form of costs and fees, engaged in discovery, and it's not until after the expiration of the statutory period did she raise this jurisdictional challenge. It puts Ms. Ray in a very difficult position of having been under the impression that full time that Ms. Reedy conceded that she was the proper party. From the face of the complaint, it is styled as against this state, but make no mistake, Ms. Reedy understood the nature of the claims. She appeared because she was the proper party to defend against any claim relating to the estate. There was no dispute about what this cause of action was. It's not one of the cases where you have a claim on a note or a contract that a decedent had signed. It's not a claim based on alleged negligence, some other tort claim against an individual who caused a motor vehicle accident and later died. It's not even a situation like in James versus Payton where the estate is named and enters an appearance as the estate, Now, that case is interesting because it was originally filed against a deceased individual.
But isn't the issue here whether or not you can amend and have relation back for statute of limitations purposes, which really has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction?
I agree that this is not a subject matter jurisdiction case. Now, with respect to the relation back, this case was not non-suited. It wasn't a successive action. And in all the cases that are cited here, the Adu, James versus Payton, those cases involve successive actions or non-suits and the like. This is not one of those cases. Ms. Reedy timely answered and appeared in the case below. There wasn't a non-suit.
You wanted to reserve 5 minutes or just below that, but you may use the time as you wish.
I will reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Aubrey Brown. I represent Catherine Reddy, Administratrix CTA of the estate of Keith F. Reddy. The circuit court correctly decided this case below when it found that the complaint in this matter was filed against an estate, which this court has held on three prior occasions is a collection of property. A collection of personal property was sued, and because of that, the circuit court ruled that a suit cannot be carried on against a collection of property.
Their response, of course, is, of course, they see that now, it's obvious, but they wanted to amend, and they were before the court, there was subject matter jurisdiction, and 8.016 appears to be a very broadly, permissively written statute.
Well, 8.016 applies to misnomers, but in these cases, this court has held that suing an estate is a misjoinder, and 8.01-6 would not apply to a misjoinder. It only applies to misnomers.
The first sentence of the statute implies that, but the second sentence reads, an amendment changing the party against whom a claim is asserted, comma, whether to correct a misnomer or otherwise, comma, relates back to, and it has a three-part test. That's pretty direct language that it's not limited to misnomers.
It is, Justice Kelsey, but in this court's decisions Payton as well as Adu, the court said that 801.6 is not available in the case where an estate is sued because it's a misjoinder. And in fact, the court's language states that a misjoinder, 801.6 does not apply to a misjoinder in these cases. And that's what the crux of this is about, is that because property was sued, the complaint on the day that it was filed was a nullity. So when the administratrix appeared, she appeared in a nullity. She appeared in a suit that never existed because it was never filed correctly. And so her appearance in that suit couldn't do anything to revive it. And what this court has made clear in all of its three prior cases is that the only remedy that a plaintiff has in these types of suits is to dismiss that suit and refile it correctly. It cannot be amended. Now, in response to that, and in particular in response to the estate of James versus Payton case, the General Assembly did get involved, and they passed 8.01-6.3. And that was in direct response to the James case, because the James case, unlike the Swan case, the James case actually did name the personal representative. Their name appeared all throughout that pleading. And despite that, this court ruled that because the estate was identified first, the estate was still the party that sued. And the General Assembly came back and essentially in two parts, in 8.01-6.3, in two parts, subsection A essentially codifies this court's rulings. It says that when a personal representative is to be sued, they have to be sued in their name, followed by their capacity. And then in subsection B, it provides a savings clause. In the event that you do not do that correctly, you can amend that pleading, but it has a caveat. Only if the correct party is identified in that pleading. And that's the challenge for appellants in this case. They have to point to some place in their pleading where they have identified the correct party, and they have failed to do that. The complaint on its face doesn't have my client's name in it at all. The administratrix's name doesn't appear. And more importantly, not only does her name not appear, but there's no allegation that a personal representative actually was appointed. There's an allegation that the will was probated, but of course a will can be probated without a personal representative qualifying.
So, but does any of that prejudice your client in any way in going forward in this lawsuit?
Well, yes, Your Honor, because when you read the complaint in its entirety, and that's what the court has said previously that it's required to do, when you get down to the prayer for relief, it's very important because the prayer for relief requests that the quote-unquote estate pay the amount of the elective share. The request for relief is that this collection of property pay, a collection of property can't pay. And that's the fundamental problem here. This is a pleading problem. This is not a personal jurisdiction case.
Right, but it seems to me it wouldn't be a whole lot of prejudice to your client because they were already in the case. Why did they answer if they didn't think that when they talk about the collection of property paying, what they really mean is that administration is just going to have to pay?
Right, and I understand that, Your Honor, but what this court has said is that the words of the complaint matter. You have to, you can't rise above your own pleadings. If you come to court and you say, I want to sue a collection of property and I want that collection of property to pay me, you can't then turn around without amending that complaint and ask for a living human being to pay. And that's the distinction between this case and the other cases that appellants have cited, is that appellants' cases all involve suits that started with a living human being or a corporate entity being sued, someone or some corporate entity that could actually be sued. This court's cases in Swan, Payton, and I Do all begin with a suit against property. So there was no suit to begin with to even
yet
amend the
yet your client responded to it. You said there's no suit, but your client responded and they were involved in it.
That's correct.
And they certainly thought that there was some obligation on their part to do, or might have been some obligation on their part to do something as a result of this lawsuit. So I guess my point really was one of a practical one as far as prejudice goes.
I would.
It's not like it was an instance where they were unaware, because you sued the wrong person. You know, I've been out in California, you know, getting a tan when I should have been in court trying to defend myself. It's not one of those types of situations.
Yes, Justice Goodwin, and I think the best response to that is to cite in the Estate of James versus Payton case in footnote 2. The court makes note that the case had been carried on for over 3.5 years, and during that time period, the motion for summary judgment that ultimately was the dispositive motion in the case didn't occur until after the defendant filed an answer and grounds of defense, carried on discovery, there were other parties added. 3.5 years of litigation passed by, and then they filed a motion for summary judgment saying, oh, wait a second, let's put the brakes on this. This case is a nullity because it was filed against the estate in the first instance. So participation in the case and the amount of time that passed in the case, it doesn't end up making a difference because the complaint itself on day one, at the instant it was filed, it was a nullity, and therefore it never existed.
Right, so you're saying practical prejudice is irrelevant to the analysis.
In this case, the practical prejudice to Mrs. Ray can't be considered because she didn't file a pleading that the court could recognize.
Well, and the point of a statute, I mean, this pits a sense of broader sense of fairness and having your cases heard versus, you know, an adversarial system of justice where we expect the lawyers to understand the rules, and if you don't, you may have to pay a price. But isn't the whole point of a statute of limitations that you still have to defend on the merits after the passage of a certain period of time? And that's the prejudice. It's not lack of notice that your client was blindsided by a lawsuit that they weren't aware of. Prejudice, seems to me, is, as with any statute of limitations, which is, look, you had X amount of time to bring your case forward in a proper way. You didn't do that. And now I shouldn't have to defend at all because the time that you had to bring this forward is past.
That's correct. And it's true that this is a very harsh result. And this court in Swan, Payton, and I Do had to make very tough decisions that were bad for the ultimate plaintiff. But in order for a plaintiff to actually get relief, they have to make a claim that a court can adjudicate. And in these cases, when a claim is filed against an estate and and then relief is asked from the state, this court has held at least three prior occasions that when you file against the state, you have sued a collection of property. And the reason I cite subject matter jurisdiction, and the court's correct that none of these previous cases talk about subject matter jurisdiction, but what the court talks about is that there is no Virginia statute that authorizes a plaintiff to file a suit against a collection of property. The General Assembly has not authorized that. And so if a suit is filed in that fashion, what is the court to do? Because the General Assembly hasn't authorized it. And the General Assembly has, in passing 8.01-6.3, noted that these cases have very harsh results, and they have given plaintiffs an out in order to try to resolve that. And so what this court has to determine, I believe the only issue in this case, as far as whether or not it can be amended and relates back, is whether or not the administratrix has been otherwise identified, which is what 8.01-6.3b states. The only way it relates back is if the administratrix is, quote-unquote, otherwise identified.
Let me ask you this. You would agree that as the, went back, you maintain that as it was filed in the trial court, it's a nullity.
Correct.
You would agree that as it is styled here, it would be proper under the statute.
Yes, and I don't think that the way that this case has been styled was appropriate. The case that was styled below, the case here should be styled exactly the same way it was styled below, and frankly, I find that to be a little bit of gamesmanship on that part.
Well, as I asked the counsel the question, case here is styled Catherine Reddy individually and as administrator of the estate of Keith F. Reddy. Now, that would be a proper naming of a party.
That would be.
All right. Recently, we held in a sanctions case that the filing of a notice of appeal and the filing of a brief in this court that violates our sanction statute, those are pleadings. And that's what allowed us to actually impose sanctions against a party for a frivolous appeal. No, the appellant doesn't raise this, but I'll simply ask you, because I think it's important to know, 8.01-6.3 says any pleading filed that does not conform to the requirements of subsection A, but otherwise identified the proper party, shall be amended on the motion of any party or by the court on its own motion, and such amendment relates back to the date of the original pleading. So my question to you is, given that this is a pleading, and we've said it is, does 8.01-6.3 avail to the appellant's benefit and make this particular appeal a live appeal, a proper appeal, and one that actually ought to be sustained under 8.01-6.3?
No, Chief Justice, I would disagree with that. If that were the case, then they could have just filed any motion and change their caption down below. So, for example, if they had made a written motion to amend, they could have just filed a motion to amend that would have been a pleading and then changed their caption. It would change what the purpose of that statute was. With the General
Assembly, that statute applies specifically to fiduciaries, and everybody knows that it was enacted in response to our decision in Payton.
Correct.
So it has a very narrow application if that concept applies. I don't know whether it applies or not. It's the first time I think anybody has ever had that situation before this court. It hasn't even been raised by the appellant. But it's an interesting question whether or not you can fix this problem on appeal.
I don't believe that you would be able to fix this problem on appeal. That would prejudice our client, because if that were the case, then this essentially, what the statute says...
Well, how much more prejudice would you be if they had done it just before the final order? All the evidence is in, everything's taken care of, motion to change the name of the respondent. How are you more prejudiced here than you would be there? And they clearly could have done it there.
Well, clearly they couldn't have done it there. That's the whole issue of this case, is that they cannot substitute in a new party without leave of court. And so they never asked this court for leave to change who the parties were from the circuit court on this appeal. That motion was ultimately denied by the circuit court because they didn't otherwise identify the appropriate party in any of their other pleadings. And then again, if this case goes back down, then they still have the original pleading, which asks for relief against the estate. And the estate, again, is just a collection of property. They're prayer for relief. It's
so,
not just the caption of the case.
I understand your response is that if they had actually complied with the requirements of subsection B, it would be a live case.
Yes.
But they didn't.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
But if they had, it would have been satisfied 8.1016.3.
Yes. What this court's case law states is that you must look at the four corners of the complaint, and within the four corners of that complaint, because the statute says any pleading that doesn't conform relates back if it otherwise identifies. And so we're asking for the complaint in this case to relate back. This appeal was filed, and this is actually a good response to your question, too. This appeal was filed after the statute of limitations had passed.
Then what am I missing? Why wouldn't we dismiss this as improvidently granted? Because the alleged party below is not before us. There's essentially an interloper under your argument. There's an interloper before us arguing. He's not a party at all.
I don't disagree with that. I think that it would be appropriate for this court to dismiss this case on those grounds.
You know what? You're the interloper.
If there are no more questions, I will cede the remainder of my time.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points that I'd like to make on rebuttal. First, Ms. Reedy was served in her capacity as the administratrix. All the pleadings below, Ms. Reedy appeared as the party defendant. She signed off on her papers, including her answer, as the defendant, the administratrix of the estate.
Part of my problem with this. I mean, on cosmic fairness grounds, you're absolutely, in the game. But we have this broader principle throughout our cases. You know, if you don't plead, for example, punitives, or you don't ask for spousal support, you don't get it. Even though you may have informed the other side by letter, by telephone, in person, whatever. So they had actual notice, but the pleading controls, or you have an alternative theory of the case, you know, something that you didn't plead. And it's tried, and the other side's aware of it, and they respond to it and all that. But hey, it wasn't in your pleading, so you lose. So when it comes to this basic complaint and what's in it, we've just across the board in our jurisprudence said, you've got to allege it, and that includes bringing the right party before the court. So part of my worry is we open this door because of the unfairness to your client in this case of not having her claim heard. What is that going to do radiating out? Is that going to, you know, upset the entire jurisprudential apple cart and the consistency we've generally had with respect to a complaint? Can you help me with that?
Absolutely. And I think that this court has decided that issue in the Lake versus Northern Virginia Women's Medical Center case from 1997. There, that was an opinion by Justice Koontz, where the wrong corporate defendant was named. And the right corporate defendant was not a party to that lawsuit. They tried to make the same arguments as Ms. Reedy made below, saying, well, you know what, you named the wrong party, we weren't before you, and the statute of limitations is run. The court disagreed and said that whether to amend under the statutes is a matter of discretion, but again, it's to be liberally construed to in situations like this, where particularly where there's a relationship between the parties, the party that's named on the face of the complaint, the party who appears, or the proper party. And there's really no change in the nature of this action at all. It's like the Grinnell's versus Legg case from 1967, where the cause of action remained the same. The defendants really suffered no prejudice by substituting the proper party. And one of the things that I heard Ms. Reedy's counsel mention was that you've got to take the words of the complaint because the words of the complaint matter. In James versus Payton, the party that was sued was an individual who'd already died. There was a motion to amend to name the estate, not to name the administrator of the estate appeared, and where the issue came down is in that complaint, the allegations against the defendant were against the dead person. So there the court held, at best, because you're referring to the defendant as someone who's passed, at best you're talking about their estate. You're not even getting to the point where you have a personal representative here. So yes, there was a passage of time, but there were several failings in that case that we don't have here. What we have is a situation where Ms. Reedy appeared from the outset and never raised any of these challenges. And the reasons that parties are required to raise these issues and raise them early on is to prevent the precise argument that we now have before the court, where a party relied on the representations of their opponent, that, oh, the proper party's here. We move forward on the merits. And it's only after the statute is run that those issues are raised. And this is an equitable proceeding. It's not a proceeding at law. The entire basis of an equitable claim such as this is to attack the res, the estate itself. And the only way that you get there is through the personal representative, in this case the administratrix. There was no confusion on her part about what this case entailed. There was no confusion on her part about who the proper party was, and it was only after the statute ran. So we ask that Your Honor reverse the decision below. Thank you.
Call the next case.
Chapman versus